one step worse than that. Because these are solutions to problems that have been deliberately and strategically manufactured. And
incorrect.
The game is pretty obvious here. Use bullshit claims to stir up baseless fear to pass unnecessary restrictions targeting particular groups.
Yeah, because you can't stand unnecessary restrictions, Mr. Seatbelt Law.
Unbelievable. That's like saying, hey, don't put the plexiglass up that's bulletproof in the bank. This bank has never been robbed before. What are you, just, this is a problem that doesn't exist. Honey, don't carry a gun because you've never been raped before.
Yeah, just some normal guys having a normal conversation.
Just hanging out, boys.
Yeah. Don't care. You don't need to carry a gun everywhere, folks. Just I'm gonna speak for the people that think you don't need to carry a gun everywhere. Matt Leck with me, David Griscom. Hello, David. This is episode 38.
Oh damn,
getting up there. Let's make sure we're coming through all right with the audio. Hopefully, those issues have been resolved a little bit to people.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure that we are good. Let's see. We've been having a little bit of technical difficulties this evening. Sorry, everybody, for the delay.
Yeah, it's. I don't know. We don't want to get into it deep into it, but it's nice to know things that you expect to be there are going to be there when you're ready to start a show. And then I'm not. This is a computer problem. Anyways, David is always there when you need him. let's start off with, we need to, I guess, do some Kremlinology is the term that really got popular in the Cold War for this sort of what's going on. Palace intrigue was what it was before that in the old feudal days. Mm-hmm. We have the situation now where it looks like Joe Biden's agenda, and this is, I stress this is Joe Biden's thing. Bernie is maybe the only one who's been really good about emphasizing that this is already a compromise. And because it is, right? Like Bernie's ask was way higher than $3.5 trillion spread out over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And now we have a situation, unless it's changed in the last, 10 minutes or so, where Jen Psaki says they believe that Kyrsten Sinema does support a reconciliation bill. Now, the English major in me points out that A is an indefinite article, as in it's not specifying a specific object. So it could be any reconciliation bill, not the reconciliation bill, and more importantly, not Joe Biden's reconciliation bill. Biden has, there's a guy, Bill Scheer, who I looked him up and I found out that he was got his start in the Majority Report in the early 2000s, but I kind of bashed him, and I would have anyway, of course.
That's pretty funny.
But anyway, he was trying to like back off this idea that there was any kind of deal in place, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
And I am not frankly that interested in exactly sussing out exactly how he's going to try to make that. Here's this. I'm going to share it. I can't yet. I haven't connected yet.
You're not able to share Twitter?
No, I'm not.
If you send it to me, I can do it for you.
Yeah, here, I'll DM this to you. And so Scheer, I think he was on like left, right, and center. But anyway, this like there's certain media figures that are like, just take the W, right? To the progressives, just do the, which is like, we've talked about this bipartisan infrastructure bill, not a W. This is like a draw at very best. And so there's this attempt to try to obfuscate what's exactly going on in a way that I emphasize Biden could stop, put a stop to if he says, this is my Build Back Better reconciliation bill.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not doing that. So I guess my prediction is that we're going to see a reconciliation bill. I don't think there's going to be any vote tomorrow, but anyway, either way, we'll see a reconciliation bill, but it's going to be trimmed even further, pruned. We'll see what exactly gets cut. As of now, it looks like the progressives are holding together. That's why I don't think there'll be a vote tomorrow. But I don't really care about the procedure that much other than to say that what happens is this moment is a reflection that the Democratic Party, Freudian slip, is too corrupt by money to govern in even the way that the moderate, because again, it's not just the squad that wants this done. This is your normal Democrats. There's only a few, and actually, okay, there might be a more that Manchin and Sinema are representing, but the general Democrat wants to get this done. And it's not going to happen because they're too corrupted by money. And so the question is, what's Joe Biden going to do about it? Is he going to continue sitting on his ass in Delaware and let it be trimmed more? I think that's exactly what's going to happen. It's more, we talked about contrast between FDR Biden. He's not hitting the bare minimum at this point, right? Like the sellout on the student loan, just bullshit about student loans, the eviction moratorium, trying to technocracy that, trying to get the CDC to do that for you instead of just a party that controls Congress. So this is a party that's too corrupted by money to even build back better.
Yeah, I mean, I think that hitting on the general corruption, I mean, it's like corruption sometimes is even like the wrong word. It's like just different interests, right, that are within the Democratic Party. And we can hit on that in a second. But just like, could you help us folks who might not be like swimming in this all the time, Matt, just understand like generally, like, you know, what exactly is going on, right? So there's two different bills, right? There's the infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill. Which originally were promised to be able to go through together, as a way to sort of reconcile, the differences that they were trying to prevent. Basically, as Manchin and Sinema early on were basically trying to cut out all the things that are in the reconciliation bill, right? So the plan was that they would vote on both of these things and sort of push them through together. And what we're seeing right now is that's coming up in the House, right? So they're basically trying to force them to the people, the Democrats in the House, to push forward the infrastructure bill without having the reconciliation bill passed in the Senate, which could mean potentially that the House could pass the infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill never happens, right? Is that sort of generally what's going on?
Exactly, yeah.
I'm just saying, like, this is one of those things where there's a real big disconnect for people who follow politics, like, really, really closely, and people, who are sort of just, catching tidbits of it here and there.
No, like, this is what, and this is a problem because what resistance Democrats are doing is obfuscating exactly what's happening. I want to go to this Bill Scheer thing now that I'm fully connected. And he writes here, and look, these guys might have some pedantic news follower point where they can say Joe Manchin said this on this date. Joe Manchin says a lot of contradictory shit. And right, like,
that's
so
very true.
So whatever the fuck, like, who gives a shit? But so Bill Scheer says, this is just a plain fact. There never was a deal between the Senate moderates and the G10. Again, like, this use of insider like lingo shit, I think maybe it's just my, I'm frustrated with this stuff. In the G10 and anyone else regarding linkage of the BIB and the BBB, these two bills. Go check the newspapers from the summer. You won't find it. So this is in response to Joe Manchin saying, have you been in talk with progressives? Manchin says, I guess there's 48 on my side. And then as questioner says, progressive feel you're not dealing in good faith that there was a deal made. Manchin said, not with me. I never knew about that. And the questioner says, you were never part of the deal. Manchin never. Now, let's just go back to, I call that disgraceful pedantry. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should have been a bit measured. Anyway, here's just a couple. This is, and I took these from their replies. I should maybe credit people, but this is just like random people throwing this back in his face, right? Here's one quote. In an effort to keep progressives in the fold, he said, he agrees with Pelosi's demand that both bills arrive in the House before either gets a vote and pointed to his $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package in March as proof he's willing to go big. My party is divided, but my party is also rational, Biden said, promising that in the event of a bipartisan bill were to get to his desk alone, I'm not signing it. Let's continue. This is a different article. We have a deal. Biden makes infrastructure compromise with senators. President Joe, I think this is the AP or USA Today, or maybe it's AP. Yeah. One of those two giant monopolies. President Joe Biden bipartisan infrastructure deal risk losing Republican supporters Friday. Just one day. Why would they lose that? After the agreement was reached, as GOP senators accused the president of blindsiding them with a major condition. After he announced the deal Thursday, Biden said he would only sign the $1.2 trillion infrastructure deal into law if Congress also passed a multi-trillion dollar package focused on human infrastructure programs like subsidized child care, home caregiving, and climate change that only Democrats support. If they don't both come, I'm not signing it. Real simple. And then Joe Manchin himself, here, oh, that's the wrong computer, says, Manchin on Biden's two-track approach. It's the only strategy we have is two-track. Reconciliation is... So, okay. Mm-hmm. I all that to say what we already knew, that Joe Manchin is a liar. He's a lying liar. And I don't know what more there is to say of that than other than I think we need to push back against the people that want to obfuscate what's happening here, mm-hmm. which is that lying liars are ruining basic governance. Because again, this $3.5 trillion is spread out over 10 years. It's the bare minimum of what a superpower should be doing in this situation.
Yeah. I mean, let's get a few things straight here. The even the combination of the reconciliation as proposed and the infrastructure bill are like so far below anything that would be adequate for the crisis that we face, both with kind of restart the economy in a way that helps out working people instead of just those at the very top, or combating the climate change. In a little bit, we're going to be talking about the global challenge there and why, you know, unfortunately, it's much bigger than even just like the kind of tit for tat versus Democrats versus Republicans in this country. A real system of opposition that's preventing us from taking meaningful action on the climate. But beyond that, it's like this is a very kind of simple thing, as Matt was saying earlier, that could be done and should be done by any kind of rational, reasonable society, right? It's irrational in the sense that it's like too small. It doesn't touch enough. It doesn't do it in a bold enough way that we would argue for. But it is even more absurd to not even be able to do this. I talked a lot yesterday about the problems with the Democratic Party and some of the tensions with like people like AOC and progressives, et cetera. But I will say that this is a real moment, right? It looks like the progressives are going to hold strong, but let's just say right now, to be very clear, if they don't, that's a catastrophe. That's a calamity. And that's a real soul searching moment, right?
You're exactly right. If they don't, and if they do, it's something entirely new, frankly.
Yeah.
That's where we're at.
Right. And like, you know, so the progressives who are saying that they are not going to vote on the infrastructure bill need to hold strong. And from all of the conversations that I've been having, from everything that I've been seeing, it seems like they will. But we need to hold them to that. Right. It's one of those things you can't, it's hard to be too faithful. And I don't want to sit here and make big predictions. I'm just saying this either way that it goes, they have to hold out. This is sort of non-negotiable.
Yep.
But beyond the kind of inadequacy of the stuff that's already proposed and those kind of criticisms, like let's understand what this moment represents. And I wanted to highlight here, I don't know if you have it or if you'd like me to put it up on screen, Matt.
The slides?
The first slide on Manchin.
I got it.
I think that this really does highlight, you know, this is nuts and bolts stuff. You know, a lot of times people on the left, they talk about campaign contributions, right? And those are bad enough. But this right here is from the New York Times. Manchin is not just somebody who like gets campaign contributions. Like this guy is, for all intents and purposes, like an oil executive.
I mean?
He's a fossil fuel executive.
Like a coal broker, I think, is like the technical term. He started brokerage in the 90s.
He founded this company in the 70s. here's the quote from the New York Times. This powerful Democrat linked to fossil fuels will craft the U.S. climate plan. Manchin profits personally from polluting industries. He owns stocks valued at between $1 million and $5 million in Ener Systems Incorporated. By just side note, why does every fossil fuel company just have the most sinister sounding name?
Yeah.
A coal brokerage firm, which he founded in 1988. He gave control of the firm to his son, Joseph, after he was elected West Virginia Secretary of State in 2000. Last year,
Just to stop there, he was a politician before that, too. It's not like he did that because he all of a sudden took office. He was already a politician.
Blind trust shit is so ridiculous as well.
Yeah, I wonder if that coal company I started.
You had already invested in the first place, right? Like, if your money's tied up in fossil fuel corporations, like, you know what's going on, even if you're not directly in the room anymore making decisions.
Yeah. I wonder what happened to that coal company I started like 15 years ago. I wonder if it's all of a sudden
if they like, would like me to block any kind of serious climate legislation. Right? Ooh, look, I mean, we all know this. It's just complete crap. Those kind of excuses, right? But just to finish up this quote, last year, Mr. Manchin made $491,949 in dividends alone. That's not everything that he owns. That's just how much he made in dividends.
Explain from dividends. Is that like
system stock?
Is dividends like that? Is that for when you work really hard, or what's that?
Yeah, no, that's when you work really, really hard and you're just smarter than the rest of it. No, it's the money that you get paid back for the amount of interest that you already hold in the company, right? Is what they do with profits instead of distributing them to workers. They go to assholes who have been lobbying for them for 30 years, right? We can pull it down now. But like this is such a really clear example of, like, again, like the campaign contributions matter. And we're going to talk about another person who gets a lot of these. But more often than not, it's like these things are like actually much more cut and dry than just like, oh, they're sending money to your congressional reelection fund, right? This person has fundamental financial interest in playing this role. Actually, while we're on, let's just show the other one too, because there's Gottheimer, right? Gottheimer, who is in the House. He's a House Democrat who has been trying to play ball to get them to put to push the infrastructure bill in for a vote early. Similar situation. Gottheimer, who is a leading like corporate Democrat who's been trying to push a vote on the infrastructure bill without reconciliation. Look where he gets his money. In all, Blackstone executives have funneled nearly $200,000 worth of campaign cash to Gottheimer since 2015. And this is the big one, though. These are the ones that really start to matter, too. And his wife, Marla Tusk, works for a lobbying and consulting firm that lists Blackstone as a client. Later on in the article, this is a piece, and again, people should always be checking out the work of our friends at the Daily Poster. This is by David Sirota and Andrew Perez. Later in this piece, they also note that Gottheimer is also one of these folks who gets a hell of a lot of money from private equity in general, right? And that's, I think we can pull down though too. Like, this is the thing, like, there's certainly money here. I don't know if you have anything you wanted to add to that.
Nah, not that I should probably say on YouTube.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, I because there's much more than this, right? This is like the first things that people are arguing or like pointing out. It's like, where is the money to like dictate these situations? But as Matt was hitting out earlier, and like these kind of conversations sort of frustrate me when we have to talk about them on the show. We have to talk about them because they're really important, right? But there's nothing that is just more boring to me than talking about like Democratic Party politics. I'm sorry. It's just like, it's just not where my attention is directed, because I don't think that it's going to help us get to where we need to go, right? This sort of shows like the limits of political maneuvering and things like that. Again, the progressives have to hold on this. They cannot vote for the infrastructure bill. This is something that there's just no excuse. If any of the arguments for why the left should have been engaging in this kind of strategy to engage on some level with the Democratic Party hold water, like the progressives have to be able to hold the line on this vote. And from all I've seen, it does look very likely that they will. And I think that'd be a good thing. Again, if they don't, I'm sorry. That's like, pretty close to game over for me on a lot of these things.
Well, you know what they're going to do is they're going to get as close to whatever not cross it, like it's going to be watered down. I'd be shocked if the progressives get us the full 3.5 Build Back Better bill, and just to the people trying to figure out what BIB and BBB were. Build Back Better is the reconciliation bill. BIB is bipartisan infrastructure bill. But if they get the full 3.5 trillion, then that is, I'm one surprised. But I think they're going to squeeze the progressives as much, and I think the progressives are going to break. And I think what's going to happen is they're going to, like, it's not going to be stuff stretched over 10 years. It's going to be a smaller number stretched over a smaller number of years.
Yeah. I think that's on point. I mean, I think that they're not going to go for the vote tomorrow from what it looks like.
Yeah.
Just because it just doesn't seem like they're going to be able to get what they want anybody. I mean, like both the centrists and the progressives, right? Yeah, but I think you're right that like what it's looking like is that this is going to deliver an opportunity to cut this spending bill even more. Know this, that none of the reason that the reason this is a problem, the reason that there's political theater about this, has nothing to do with the people. This has nothing to do with messaging. All of the programs that are sort of laid out and like are laid out are extremely popular. Helping out working families, fixing roads, getting rid of lead pipes. Like these are things that people fundamentally support. The only criticism that's substantial on it is from people like us who are saying this is nowhere near close enough. And remember, when we're talking about these things like $3.5 trillion, you're talking about what, $350 billion a year, right? The reason that there's a lot of pushback from the oil and fossil fuel companies is because there are some kind of like attempts to invest in green energy. There are some trying to pushes to make utilities use less oil, gas, and coal, and you know, along with other things. The big reason that people are worked up is because they're trying to increase the corporate tax rate by a few percent, right? But again, while we should be taxing corporations much, much more, at the end of the day, this is like sort of marginal fights for the vast majority of Americans. It's not something that people are getting really worked up. The opposition is coming from corporate lobbyists. And I was just talking to Matt before this. And I think, you know, help me articulate this, because it's one of those things that can be a little bit difficult to just say very clearly. But the thing about this is that, like, yes, it shows that the Democratic Party is inept. Right? It shows that there's a lot of bad actors within the Democratic Party, but there's a kind of like simplistic progressive message, which is like, well, they're all corrupt and they're all like, you know, bad folks. And like, very true, the vast majority of them. But I think what it points to even more is that the Democratic Party is just structurally broken. What I mean by that is the contradictions within that organization are so much that they're not even able to get in like their kind of basic policy platform here, right? The fact is that they're trying to hold all of these different competing interests in society, from Exxon to, you know, supposedly like the American worker, right? And then they have to do all these different things that they're not even unified enough as a party to be able to act in unison, right? Maybe a better way to think about it is, it's not necessarily that Biden's having secret conversations with Manchin and Sinema behind the scenes to say like, you need to go out there and block this bill to like give me cover, right? They might like that they're doing it, but that, you know, it's not orchestrated. This is not scripted on any level. The fact is that within this party organization, there are just so many interests that are contradictory to anything that would be remotely progressive, right? And the fact is that the money is the most powerful and dominant form within the party, and those are the people who people pick up the phones for in the party, right? Manchin is a person who has standing calls with Exxon, right? Mm-hmm. You know, even the progressives don't have that kind of opening for leftist organizations and working class groups, right? The fact is that the Democratic Party, just as a political structure, is just so, has so many different contradictions and warring factions within it that it's not even able to function coherently as an organization, right? Which is, you know, for us on the left who are trying to do something different, is something that we sort of, I don't know, we understand and we wrestle with. But this is something that is just clear as day. And it does show, in my opinion, why a lot of this kind of infiltration strategy within the Democratic Party is proving itself to just be a complete dead end. The only answer to any of this shit is going to be mass politics, because mass politics could get them to do what they're supposed to do. Mass politics could get them to push through these kind of things. Again, like, we should be aiming for higher, right? But mass politics is the only thing that is going to be able to make sure that they're not able to basically be able to strangle and cut any kind of just basic, not social democratic, not even really progressive, just like kind of like old school standard liberal program.
Yeah, the compromise is the compromise. And I mean, I don't want to bring up all the AOC stuff. I just think, like, the context of that is, it's kind of like, do the Oklahoma City Thunder have good jerseys? Well, when they're, like, going to the Western Conference Finals because they got Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook, as in having success and getting shit done, then, mm-hmm. you know, that stuff looks good. If you're not, if you're getting swamped in a reconciliation fight, that stuff, all of a sudden, yeah, no, get that shit out of here. It looks trash. I don't know, there's probably more to talk about on that, but I think you're right in that look, like, it's interesting to see the limits of these parties. We saw the limits of the Republicans with the whole, like, John McCain thumbs down for healthcare thing. This is exactly, this is frankly the only money in the bank as far as, like, my argument for why I'd prefer Democrats to control, like, say, Congress, is because it puts this shit to the test. It's because instead of them, like, fundraise, I mean, they still try to fundraise and about, like, the eviction moratorium or whatever the fuck, right? But instead of them being able to blame that on Republicans, it's like, no, we all get to see what this is. And I also, like, think there's a weird convergence of, like, the next place people care to go with that is what it means in the midterms. And who gives a shit at all what that means? Like, I don't know. I think as far as what I think we should do here is just elaborate the lessons that are being drawn from this. And this is a clear sign that just money is corrupting the basic governance, like centrist, moderate, whatever you want to call it, governance. Mm-hmm. They're not able to even do that, being held hostage by people who are, like David said, like venal, awful, representatives of corporate interests. But
I would answer that. Like, I think that the point is generally good that you can sort of expose, like, the rot that the Democratic Party sort of represents, right? Mm-hmm. That, like, not only are there a lot of bad folks in it, but it's just, like, completely unable to deliver on these kind of promises. But I would sort of warn about this one aspect. The thing that worries me about this whole scenario, it's less so about the kind of articles that we're going to be reading about in Politico over the next couple of weeks about, like, what was going on behind the scenes in these kind of fights, but more so the challenge that we've been given and we've been trying to give to our audience and way of thinking more boldly and radically about politics, which is to make working class people think that politics is like a avenue to change their life. Right. And I get worried sometimes that, like, when progressives are the ones fighting so, so hard to get just a $350 billion a year, increase in spending, to sort of, like, half tackle some of these, like, major issues that people care about, that, you know, it can sort of lead to a kind of general cynicism of, like, oh, remember, I voted in the most important election of my lifetime again, for the Democrats who are promising to do something different. And then what ended up happening was, like, you know, a lot of watered down stuff and not too much delivery, right? I just think it's really important to, and the problem right now, and this is, like, well, I've been having a rough time with this over the past 48 hours, if I'm being honest, of sort of realizing where we're at structurally as a left right now, in the absence of, like, a kind of coalition that we had, like, with Bernie, in the absence of, like, viable political organizations that are sort of marching forward, to sort of realize that, like, we don't have the avenue right now for mass politics, and we need to find a way to build them. We have to find a way to build it really, really quickly. And in the meantime, there are these really critical fights too that are happening, right? Because it would be a disaster if all of this got scrapped, I think, as well, right? I just think, because we just aren't going to touch climate for years if they aren't able to push this through. It's just like it's a difficult kind of contradiction to try to find ourselves. It's like finding a way that we can articulate that, like, we, like, vehemently, like, disagree with this kind of incrementalist messaging, and we sort of know what looks like it's coming. Finding a way to fight to make sure that the mansions and cinemas don't get their way as well. I don't know, without sort of, like, demoralizing folks in the future, because I could see very well how people can see this and say, like, well, politics is a dead end, right? In the sense of, like, you know, this is what happens after, like, we seem like we're challenging all these institutions and structures. And, like, now we're fighting again, you know, to just get marginal stuff compared to, like, a Green New Deal, all the things that people were, like, so inspired by a few years ago. The thing that gives me hope, so not to add on, like, a sour note, is that while our political entryways seem to be sort of barred, at least for the moment, there have just been mass popular movements across the country, particularly in labor. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show, right? Like, the thing is, like, if this was just happening without just the mass mobilization of people in other avenues, I think it would be quite a worrying moment. I think the situation right now is we need to find those polls that can attract folks who are seeing this for the bullshit that it is, and trying to build something different, because I don't know, waiting for this proceduralist stuff to like sort of pan out, I think is a dead end.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're seeing that. Yeah. I mean, it is despicable just to notice like how much this spending actually would do for people, and we're not even able to. This is the thing that's crazy to me as like a media professional, is like, it's bullshit. A lot of this is bullshit. Like, Joe Manchin gets on there and he talks about the Constitution, or talks about, and you see this or that, and he's concerned about inflation. He knows it's bullshit. It's not meant to be responded to or reasoned mm-hmm. with. It's just a placeholder for a comment. And it's the same thing with cinema. Like, and just as an observer, right? That's the thing, is I don't think there is a lot of activism to be done. I mean, you can call your representatives and say, don't vote for the bipartisan bill and I, God bless you if you do that. But ultimately, like, this is a train crashing, I think, in a certain
I think
way.
The benefit that could come, I mean, I would actually like it if there were to be a vote tomorrow, just to have the progressives have to do something bold like that.
Yeah.
To sort of like encourage that kind of tension within the party, I think would be beneficial.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it's just a difficult situation right now. And the problem is that like, we just can't look for this to be the avenue. And by the way, that doesn't mean like retreating into protest. Like, the avenue has to be like becoming very, very political, and like finding ways that we can start to organize in a way to flex our muscles. What I'm saying right now is like, it feels like the left is in very much like a disarray, unorganized state. And this has to be a kind of wake up call, not just in that the feeling that something needs to be done, because a lot of people feel like something needs to be done, but starting to see what kind of things we need to be building to be able to challenge this. Because I don't know, just hoping that like the right messaging, it just doesn't seem like it's going to be changing.
Well, what you there, Ezra Klein, is saying?
Yeah, actually, yeah. Why don't we do that real quick? Because this is like, this is just so ridiculous. I can pull it up.
Yeah, if you got it.
This is just such a ridiculous way this is just such a great reminder of, you know, the kind of big brains, you know, pundits on the Democratic Party side who don't get this moment. And this is why I'm saying, like, the only answer to this has to be mass politics, because the fact about this is that the only reason that there's opposition right now to the infrastructure bill or the reconciliation bill has nothing to do with people. Like, it has nothing to do with the vast majority of American people or voters or workers, because these programs are just extremely popular. Mm-hmm. If anything, people would want more of them rather than less of them. The reason that we're seeing opposition is, again, because the Democratic Party is, you know,
too corrupt to function.
Too corrupt to function, and it just is too much of a contradictory structure to be able to do even what it wants to do. But here's Ezra Klein saying, the wise David Simos just made a very good point to me over the phone. One problem for the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill is the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. The rescue plan was defined by the stimulus checks. This bill is defined by its price tag. The point isn't that the bill costs too much. It's that it's never found its headline policy, the part that stands in for the whole. There's lots of great stuff in the package, but nothing that has come to define it, to make it so if you're against the bill, you're against this. I'll add, this is just another problem created by the filibuster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And this is one of those moments, right, when you realize that the people who are doing the vast majority of the commentary, and in fact the vast majority of the strategizing, don't understand the political moment here, right? Because the problem is not that Manchin is like, you know, dipping into some kind of wellspring of opposition to this kind of package. Right, we haven't seen
the people any are so time. Concerned.
Even on the right, even the right hasn't been able to mobilize their, you know, their people against this. Right,
they don't give a fuck. Yeah, they're not doing anything about
they're
it.
They're not doing anything.
They're talking about basketball players getting vaccinated.
Yeah, exactly. Ted Cruz is just like freaking out about agreeing for a black person for the first time in his life. Right.
Oh well, yeah, exactly.
you know, it's just like. they're just not on the you know, they're not on the playing field at all because they don't need to be, right? The problem here is just the fundamental structures of the Democratic Party. And the reason it's just worth bringing up is just to show you that, like, they don't have an answer for this at all. The Democratic Party doesn't know how to operate in a sense to tap into the support that already exists for these programs and for what's within the spending bill, right? The fact is not that they need to sell it to folks. Folks are already for it. The fact is that they have created a party structure that is so dominated by financial interests, be they financial interests or like industrial capital, like oil and gas and fossil fuels, that they're not even able to put out the kind of basic platforms that they run in the first place, right? Like, that's one of those things where it's like, don't look outside, look within your own house if you want to start to do something different. But I think as Matt was noting earlier, it's like, I don't think that their Manchin and Sinema are sort of getting orders from Biden and Pelosi, you know, to be doing what they're doing. But there's a reason. I mean, it's very clear that Biden and the Democratic Party's like leadership are sort of holding back in a way that's really amazing, when there just is so much dirt against both Sinema and Manchin, you know, that the only outlets that are really pushing it are like The Intercept and, you know, Jacobin and
Daily Poster, yeah.
Daily Poster, right? I think sort of shows that there is like a kind of...
We just had Trump. What would Trump do if he was trying to get something passed and it was Sinema and Manchin? He'd be going at them all the time. Yeah. And Joe's not going to do that because it's not worth Joe's time and effort. Sleepy Joe.
Yeah, well, so we'll see what happens, and we'll find out tomorrow. I'm sure I'll have more about it next week. Later in the show, we're going to be talking about these carpenter strikes in Washington, and I'm telling y'all, that's the hope, along with the fact that working people all across the country seem to be having a little bit more confidence. We need to start preparing ourselves for what looks like we're going to get an onslaught from both you know, the bosses, and also potentially from the government itself, trying to take back the benefits that have helped folks sort of secure better conditions for themselves. Mm. But before we get to that, we have to turn to another extremely cheery subject, which is COP26.
Yeah, exactly. It's another cause for super optimism. Maybe some. We'll let the experts discuss that. But yeah, we had a good conversation with Adrian Martinez and Sam Goodman of La Ruta del Clima. And, you know, I think I'm proud of it. It's a sort of a TMBS style coverage of climate change, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously Sam was close with Michael, but it was good to talk to those guys. Do you have anything you want to say before we jump off? Oh, yeah. One second here. Sam Hoadley Brill for patrons this mm-hmm. weekend. We are going to get into all sorts of things. We're going to talk about the critical race theory to the school boards, local school boards, sort of like new Tea Party action we're seeing, although has that been swamped by mask mama bears? Who knows? Anti-mask mama bears. We'll also talk about Chris Rufo, and we'll get very conceptual talking about James Lindsay. Yeah. So that's all for patrons this weekend. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. We're well past 900 now.
We're on our way to 1,000. So y'all keep showing up. We're really looking forward to being able to expand the things that we're doing.
I can taste the brisket already.
Hell yeah. And then on that, before we go, is there something that we have for the post game that you wanted to tease? Then we have some.
Yes. So yet another version of this. So we'll play two things. It made waves, including Alex Jones covering the Majority Report, that Sam Harris turned on Brett Weinstein in the rational sort of intellectual dark web because of his anti-vax stuff. There's another great, let's see if I have it, but there's another great sort of come to Jesus moment, or the scales fall from my eyes. I'm reading John Milton, so I'm feeling very biblical lately. But the scales fall from your eyes in terms of people realizing in the skeptic rational community that these Weinstein bros,
charlatans.
Who would have thought? I mean, I would have thought. I've been thinking that for a while. But yeah, so we'll talk about that in the post game. It is very interesting to see people kind of come to that realization. More and more people are saying, folks, that these guys are not rational, not skeptics, not logical. So yeah, that's I'm very excited to talk about that. Anyways, We will see you in about 45 minutes after this this interview, folks, and where we talk about those strikes. See you then. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, David Griscom. Hey, David.
How's it going?
And joining us now, Adrian Martinez and Sam Goodman of La Ruta del Clima. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks, David.
Thank you for having us.
Now, Sam, can you just give us, before we get to the mission of what you guys are about, your connection to Michael?
So Michael was a friend of mine. Adrian and I are based in Costa Rica. We actually met up right after the Bernie AOC rally together in Brooklyn. He came down here, talked a little bit about doing some shows out in Costa Rica, and unfortunately he passed, but I've been a huge fan of the show and a huge fan of the work that you two do. My favorite podcast, my favorite YouTube show. So that's my connection with Michael.
Costa Rica was really in Michael's heart, definitely. What are you going to say, David?
Oh, I was just going to say he was talking about it nonstop after his visit. He very much had a good time. So thank you for that.
So Adrian, the mission of La Ruta del Clima, what should we be focusing on when we talk about justice and climate change?
Yeah, sure. La Ruta del Clima is an NGO based in Costa Rica. We work on human rights and basically from a science approach to the whole climate governance and the climate crisis. And so when we talk about justice from like global south perspective, we have to talk on the root causes of climate change, which is basically capitalism, extreme consumption that certain countries in the world have. And this has generated a change in our whole climate and so many repercussions in our ecosystems that are destroying lives in the global south, especially vulnerable communities that have really nothing to do with the emissions or with all the carbon that is transforming their communities, transforming the relationship they have with nature and their ability to basically exist. So La Ruta del Clima focuses on bringing a Latin American perspective, a Central American perspective into the global discussions in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and doing politics, doing research, talking about justice, talking about human rights, and basically calling out for the irresponsibility that certain countries, including the US, the European Union, China, has had during the whole these 30 years, basically, of climate negotiation and trying to avoid responsibility and block any real possession from or real framework, especially anything regarding with money or finance, to help communities, to help develop the countries in the global south that are just being impacted with this adverse effect of climate change, basically loss and damage that is pretty much just grabbing whole countries and putting them in a cycle of rebuilding and being destroyed again and again, year by year, by either flooding or fires or drought. And this is basically driving, for example, in lots of countries, like more poverty or people being forced to exercise the human right to just cross a border and find safety somewhere else because where they live or they were born is no longer feasible to live and to have a nice life like their forefathers had.
Yeah, it's something, and I'd be curious to hear both of y'all's thoughts on this, that I've been noting to folks in the U.S., climate activists, is that there's been this kind of slogan. It's like, that basically, climate change in itself is going to be the death knell of like capitalism, right? And what we're unfortunately seeing more and more, and it's a very frightening future, but there is a future where it's like, it's not like it doesn't seem like these oil companies and people who are very responsible for climate change are just going to wake up one day and say everything needs to be different, right? And there is a very frightening scenario that I'm seeing, even in the United States, with migration of people from areas that are very much threatened by climate change into parts of the country that are less threatened by it, that there very much could be a situation where there's a part of the world that is bearing the full brunt of climate catastrophe. And there are these little enclaves of communities of super rich folk who are basically able to sit on the profits that they've extracted from the rest of the globe as people suffer.
That's for sure. Like what we see is that there's some safe havens that, I mean, if you have the money to adapt to climate change, if you mm-hmm. have the money to do infrastructure, to take food from people that produce it and use it for yourself to pay for the health, to move away from danger, then you're fine. I mean, you can be fine for many decades. Eventually, the human society might collapse. It's something that the Intergovernmental Panel of Scientists mm-hmm. have said. It's where we're going. There's no doubt about that. But in the meanwhile, in the decades, if we don't do something, well, the rich and the powerful with their guns and colonialism will just keep poor people on one side where they die and starve, and the others will just probably just take the resources they're available and leave it out as long as they have. So it's an issue about extreme injustice, and it's an issue about using power to keep from one side. And you see it, for example, in the policies of migration that the European Union has, like sinking people when they're in their boats crossing the Mediterranean Sea. Or you see it now recently in the US with the horses and the whips and all the, in general, the exercise of anti-migration policies in Latin America that many countries are doing to deter people. But what those people that are migrating, that are just exercising a human right to move out of danger, they're just basically the most vulnerable people. And it's also super interesting that the even more vulnerable people, the more poor people, that those that have no responsibility for all the stuff that is going on, they can't move. They're just stuck in their communities, stuck in the flooding, stuck without food. So there is like the two side of those. Those who can move are actually in some ways privileged to do so. And those that are really being affected or even more affected can't even leave their communities because they just have no resources. So yeah, there is this force, like it is the idea that maybe the system will collapse, but the system is just getting even more violent and just sort of protecting those who have the money to oppress others.
And I think this is just on a scale that we're not even prepared to see. The latest World Bank report saying, you know, by mid-century we could see over 200 million climate migrants, and what would this mean and what kind of shock would that give to the system when you see this flux, and where is it coming from the global south? And yeah, I don't think that there's a system in place that's prepared for it. I mean, you can see like the Biden administration says, oh, well, we're weighing provisions for climate migrants, but there's no foresight as to the level of what we're about to experience.
Yeah, don't come, but they don't even give the climate finance they promise anyway. So it's just a complete hypocrisy from their side.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, no, go ahead, man. I was just gonna say, we're going to get into some of that stuff regarding COP26 in a moment, but.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, like, that's why what you guys are saying is so important, because the domestic politics message from the Democrat side, it's, I guess, we'll remove the reins and not use the reins on the people that are crossing. And the Republicans are like, yeah, we should sink them in the Gulf of Mexico before they get to the land in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, It's. I mean, the domestic stuff in the United States. I just think that there's more. There's a lot of, like, beyond just denial of, like, people who just outright deny climate change. I think that there is a lot of people who I don't think have really reckoned with what climate change will mean for global society and even just American society.
I guess with that is that there's this. And it's in a denial that is in every society, that somehow it's not happening, and somehow we just can keep going as it's nothing going on. And it's just some very creepy psychological thing that even though there's facts, even though you know it's there, somehow this addiction to protecting the status quo, to protecting your privilege, to protecting this idea of that the only solutions that we can have is in the current economic system, and that there's no way that we can question that or think any other alternative, and then we have to stick to the current power framework that is in place. It's just keeping us down. It's just obstructing change. And I mean, we have been doing this for 30 years of negotiations that keep on the same thing. We just keep increasing emissions. We have never gotten them down. There's no finance really for the actions that should be taken. So there's this big contradiction, not only in the national arena, but also in the international arena, because we're just sort of in denial that we need to change.
And you see in the, you know, the current domestic plans, what the U.S. submitted to the Paris Agreement in terms of the revised contributions. And they're looking to cut emissions by 50 to 52% by 2030, which is kind of in line with the scientists are saying. But when you ask, when you drill down, when they ask John Kerry, you know, the climate envoy, how are we going to cut this? He says, oh, well, you know, we'll, there'll be some new technologies that'll be invented and we'll figure it out. But there's not really a roadmap to get there. They start to get the numbers right. You start to see some of the figures move in the right direction. But, you know, the scale, the amount of money that's being devoted to climate change, if it makes it in the Build Back Better plan, who says it will be? But, you know, that's not even on the scale we're thinking. I mean, just to start, you got to look at what, you know, what Bernie was talking about when the trillions and trillions of dollars.
No, Adam Tooze has, The Economist has a pretty good measure for sort of judging how serious climate change, you know, policies that are supposed to combat climate change are, by comparing the amount of money going into it to the amount of money that Americans spend on cat food per year, which you'd be very disappointed to find that oftentimes the things that were being floated around are nowhere near enough. But I mean, I wanted to zoom out a little bit and talk about, you know, COP26, because this is going to hit on a lot of these different issues. I will note, you know, it was a little kind of gallows humor going on their website and seeing like the first line saying like, we've been doing this for 30 years, right? As if that's a kind of celebration and not an indictment. The problem of this, but I mean, not to poison the well too much, but how is y'all feeling going into, you know, COP26?
I mean, it's interesting because you see momentum moving in different directions. So one of the biggest things in terms of COP26 will be getting enough countries to make the contributions towards climate finance. So climate finance is what developing countries need to transition to low carbon societies. And the goal that was established in Copenhagen, reaffirmed in Paris, was to reach $100 billion, which was, you know, pretty modest at the time, and it still hasn't been doing yet. And the recent reports show that we're not going to make the goal we didn't make the goal by 2020. We're about maybe 80% of the way there. Mm-hmm. So trying to get to that $100 billion goal that was established in 2009, but it looks like things are moving in a positive direction. You can see Biden actually just doubled his climate finance pledge ahead of COP26 from about 5.7 billion to 11.4. You see certain things moving in the right directions. You see certain things that were off the table start to move onto the table. So one thing we specialize in, La Ruta del Clima, we talk about issues of loss and damage. So when you look at the pillars of climate action, you have mitigation, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. You have adaptation, and which is adapting to the effects of climate change. But there's really a third pillar of climate change, of climate action, and that's loss and damage. For things that are go beyond adaptation, if you're a small island developing state and, you know, sea level rise wipes out your nation, you know, it goes beyond that. And so loss and damage has historically been this really hostile issue, especially because, you know, countries like the US and European nations and Australia, they don't want to accept liability or compensation. They don't want to accept that their historical emissions are responsible for causing, you know, this mass destruction. So you can start to see things that were previously off the table creep on the table, and you start to see certain people grasp a sense of urgency. It's actually been sort of surreal to watch Boris Johnson, of all people, really kind of, it really seemed to sink in the effects that climate changes, and the fact that if we don't have a successful COP, the world's going to be in pretty bad shape, as, you know, what the latest science reports have been indicating.
So if you take like maybe a broader approach to it, first of all, like in the organization thing, it's just like a shit show. It's like it's so uncertain, everything. There's no certainty how will happen. How do you get there? It's just like just an adventure, or a risky adventure of putting your life in danger to get to the conference. And I mean, to this point, you don't even know where you're going to do quarantine and so on. So it's been an organization sort of nightmare that has put many countries already very angry and emotional about it. So it's going to be a very high pressure sort of place, which for me can go either two ways. It can collapse with no sort of good decision, or pressure, as Sam says, to position certain issues that are very political, and then force the hand of big players to sort of give in to avoid some like open conflict and so on. And maybe the next COP could have even more maybe progressive or radical results. That's like the positive side of it. Mm-hmm. On the negative side, I mean, we're basically just sort of hitting like the line of this like voluntary approach to climate action, which sort of the Paris Agreement set out. Like basically everybody says what they want to do, and sort of with pressure, countries sort of try to align themselves with no obligation, nothing legal, no way to force you, no way to force Brazil to actually do something better than they are proposing, even though it's insufficient. So there's no real way to force people or countries through legal means under the Paris Agreement. So it's basically just voluntary. But what we see is that is not working. Emissions are not being reduced with the voluntary commitments they have. They're not even halfway what is needed, and the finance is never there. And it's, for example, and the finance for the vulnerable community is non-existent. It's never on the table being discussed. So we're seeing that we're reaching a point where climate change is, we're running out of time to meet the goals that the Paris Agreement has. We're going over the temperature increase that is being that was agreed, and the forecast is super bad, and the system is sort of not working. So either we have some radical change and finances start pouring in, and countries actually start assuming their responsibilities, or we will have some sort of systemic collapse, because there's already many climate activists, and I mean seasoned climate activists, that have been participating for decades in the system. That are just, why would we go to COP? It doesn't work. So what's the purpose of going there if there's no change, if emissions are not reduced, if vulnerable people get no funding, if countries just keep their own, if developed countries, if the global north just takes no change, no action, no significant transformative action. So there's no point to it. So we're basically reaching that sort of very complex place where people are going to this conference extremely stressed, under very harsh conditions, with very bad results, with no money, and bringing back the justice issues that have been there since 1990, when the UNFCCC convention was created, because the issue of loss and damage was there on the negotiations of the convention, but has systematically been ignored by countries. And now that we cannot deny it anymore, that the island people in the islands are suffering, that people are suffering droughts in Central America, that fires are raging all across the global north, and that there's flooding, incredible flooding in Germany. Now that we can see it, now we can just not even imagine it. There's nowhere else to go. And I think this conference is going to be a very interesting politically, and hopefully not a sad experience of human nature, but hopefully we have some real results that sort of save our society soon.
Well, I'd be curious though, like maybe look at some of the fights that are coming, right? Because the thing that we're seeing, you know, like even Boris Johnson was going on at the UN about how it's really easy to be green, right? And you hear a lot of talk from the US too. Like it's becoming very popular for politicians to talk about, you know, climate change, and they believe in all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to the pocketbooks, when it comes to money, we have a different conversation. There's a couple of things that y'all note in your report, and I'll pull it up in just a second, that are going to be some of the challenges of COP26. And I was just curious if y'all could maybe explain the tensions here for our audience. But the first one is on resolving Article 6. Would either of y'all be able to sort of explain what that is, and, you know, what the outlook is looking like? I'm pulled this up too for everybody to see.
Sure. So when you talk about Article 6, you're looking at global carbon market mechanism. So you're looking at kind of allowing certain countries to continue to pollute, to use carbon offset mechanisms. And this has been one of the most contentious issues at the climate conference in recent years. So more or less the entire Paris rulebook, which is the rulebook that was created to carry out the Paris Agreement, has been resolved except for Article 6, because you know, it's been so contentious in terms of how this should be resolved. And in a lot of ways, it's an article that doesn't work. It's a mechanism that doesn't work. And given, you know, being able to continue to pollute is just something that we can't have. And then really a poor article resolution Article 6 resolution undermines the integrity of the Paris Agreement. So this started, the Paris rulebook was supposed to be hashed out at COP24 in Katowice in 2018. It failed, largely in part because Brazil made a last minute push. They had just elected our friend Bolsonaro. And they just elected our friend over there and kind of just made a big push because Brazil was looking at something called double counting. And it's really one of the things that undermines the integrity of this article. At the last climate conference, which took place in Madrid and was hosted by Chile, once again, this was not resolved. And there is some hope that a resolution will happen this year. I'm not personally not optimistic. But it is a really problematic resolution. Adrian, I don't know if you have something to add to that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, from what Sam says, there's three things that are very important. First of all, any of the actions that can sort of come from the implementation Article 6 can be very good in terms of reducing emissions. But for example, if there's no human rights considerations, we can go back to things like happening in the decades ago in terms of generating projects where communities are harmed in the hope of reducing emissions, especially indigenous communities. So it's a very contentious sort of this sort of engine of the Paris Agreement has to be very, very tuned and has to have very important limitations that sort of do not generate harm, because this has happened in the past, for example, with the Kyoto Protocol, where communities' human rights were violated, for example, generating dams or things like that and being displaced to do conservation. So it's a very high stakes sort of article. On the other hand, it's also, there's this idea of non-market mechanisms that could also reduce emissions. And this is something that is being pushed by Bolivia historically, and nobody really knows what it is. So sort of putting some letters to actually know what that is and to make it a possibility to do things of reducing emissions beyond just market approaches, natural capital, that is super important. But that's something that most negotiators have no clue what that is. And it's just there because of a political fight Bolivia sort of leader a while ago. So that's something very important to accomplish, to have this possibility. And that is something, for example, indigenous people that do not trust the market approaches want. Mm-hmm. And also communities that have a very close relationship with ecosystems are very concerned. And in the issue, in the case of Latin America, that's super important, because we'll receive so many projects and investments due to Article 6. So the whole idea of carbon colonization, of more colonizing projects to take your land, just sort of save emissions to protect the development in other countries in the global north, it's a concern that is across the board in Latin America, especially for NGOs, because this could just spark some new colonization sort of actions in our territories, especially in indigenous territories or rural areas, in the sake of reducing or fixing carbon or protecting the Amazon, for example. So it's a very, very interesting fight. It's a fight where the mention of human rights has been super opposed by many countries. And so the environmental safeguards and human rights safeguards, it's also an issue. So we depend on this article to sort of move forward, but at the same time, it just could really generates harm if it is not appropriately structured. So it's a very tricky situation with this.
And when we talk about looking at resolutions, the U.S. remains a key wild card, because when you see, and you've seen a lot of continuity between Obama and Trump in terms of the line that the U.S. took on certain areas of the negotiation. So a lot of it rests on, if we see a resolution on Article 6, if we make progress, a lot of it, will we see a new U.S. delegation, or will Biden and Kerry largely be a reversion to the Obama era?
Hmm. Yeah, and I know you, Sam, had sort of mentioned how there's been some positive developments on the $100 billion climate finance goal regarding Biden. But I mean, could y'all just sort of help folks understand like the role that this has, not only in combating climate change, but as a kind of, as a justice issue as well, right? When it comes to avoiding green colonization. I mean, one thing, for example, in the US, I remember There was, I think it was AOC's Green New Deal. So one of the early plans came out with this idea that the United States could become the leader in the Green Revolution by patenting a bunch of, you know, technology and then selling it to the rest of the world, right? I can see that that's probably not something, and like she, to her credit, pressure, she dropped it. But I can see a lot of people, I can imagine a lot of folks who maybe don't have the same kind of people in their ear like AOC does, sort of trying to find a way, you know, for a greening economy to be, you know, a new gold rush, especially in parts of the world where funding for any project is usually something that's difficult to come by.
Well, climate finance at its core is key for developing countries. Most developing countries don't have the resources to transition to a low carbon economy without the assistance from, you know, developed nations who are responsible for this whole crisis, who are responsible for the vast majority of historical greenhouse gas emissions. So when we look at climate finance, we need to, you know, it brings up, you know, the concept of climate justice in terms of having these countries and be able to finance the technologies to reduce their carbon emissions as well as to adapt to the effects of climate change. You're looking at both mitigation and adaptation as key to climate finance. And the $100 billion per year goal, which was established in 2009, it's critical, but in many ways the four, and we're not even meeting the four yet. And when you look at certain studies, there's been a couple of really good climate finance studies that have come out, and the majority show that the U.S. should be providing at least 40% of climate finance based on historical emissions, the size of the economy, et cetera. You know, in terms of financing the Green Climate Fund, Obama just pledged a couple $1 billion and Trump reneged on the majority of it. So the U.S. has given so little in terms of climate finance. And so Biden, when around April, around Earth Day last year, he announced his intention to his climate finance pledges, which was pegged at about $5.7 billion, which is an awfully low sum. If the goal is $100 billion, the U.S. should be providing at least 40% based on historical submissions. He's only offering $5.7 billion. The majority, a lot of NGOs, environmental groups, and human rights groups were asking for at least $12 billion. So he provides just $5.7 billion. It got a lot of criticism, especially in the climate community. Last week, they upped it, or 2 weeks ago, they upped it, doubled it to about $11.4 billion. And, you know, I mean, at this point, it's simply just a pledge, but you do see, you know, countries not accepting their role, not accepting their historical missions, trying to get out of liability, trying to get out of any sort of compensation that they can. And right now, what we're seeing is we're missing the target of a modest goal that was set back in 2009, reaffirmed in 2015. It's 2021. We got to get to $100 billion this year at COP, one way or another.
So also on that topic, one of the key concerns, at least from Global South or Latin American perspective, is that much of that finance is just more debt. They're loans. So we're getting loans to sort of clean up the mess that the developed world made. So we get loans to not develop using carbon, and we get loans to adapt to the impacts that the developed world created, and that just increases national debt. And if you see it, I mean, just to put like a perspective from a small country like mine in Costa Rica, I mean, right now we have this huge deficit where you can, once you retire, nobody hires a new person. Just the social services are being reduced, and everything that is social is being underfunded, cut, limited. So we have no funding for example, a major transformative adaptation projects or mitigation projects. I mean, we just depend on loans, for example, for an electric train or things like that. And also to put into perspective, this $100 billion are for both adaptation and mitigation actions. So, and this go all across the world being accessed. But when we talk about, which is my topic, I mean, of course, I'm going to talk about loss and damage. When we talk about loss and damage, we're talking about $500 billion per year. So that's five times more than what is being pledged now for both loss and for mitigation and adaptation. So that's sort of to put into perspective how huge the difference is between what the impacts of climate change cost to people and that communities are paying out of their pocket with no help from the international community, and the little bit that developed countries pledge to help mitigation and adaptation actions, and they don't even pay for that, even though they pledged it years ago. So it's just like a huge thing for the real implementation of climate action. If we don't get real finance, and especially if we don't get real finance for, as Sam mentioned, for the three pillars of the Paris Agreement, not just for the things that generate business, because the other issue is that this climate finance is based on the idea that you have to make climate action profitable, a business opportunity. So it's about selling technology. It's about having countries use your technology so you generate dependencies. And then not only you give them the money to sort of put this train or put this solar powers, but you sell them the batteries and the technologies and you own the patents. So all this is transformation in the economy that the global South is undergoing with the patents and the technology and the resources and the loans of the developed world, who costs the climate change at the end. So it furthers the dependency and this sort of lack of self-determination that the global South can have, and on the basis of the same crisis that the global North caused. So it's sort of you never lose. You're never losing. You're in the side of power. You make a profit from your own fault and your harm, and still you give them loans to pay you to fix your problem.
Adrian, could you just historicize the resistance to the loss damage at the UN for us? You know, you mentioned it's been 20 years sort of on the back burner. Has it been something that's been gradually receiving more support, or is it something that all of a sudden people are just realizing we need to do this and we'll have to support it?
Well, that is the super interesting question, because for me, I mean, I've been on this about 7 to 8 years. So I thought loss and damage was this new thing, like, oh man, we're finally getting to the crisis. We see the fires, the drought, the Amazon is on fire. Oh, it has to be now that we're putting attention. But I mean, in the research that our organization has done, I mean, from this, the negotiation of the UNFCC, of the Convention on Climate Change, the Pacific Islands, Vanuatu, and all those were already asking for loss and damage. They were already asking for financial mechanism. They were already asking for insurance. They were already asking for the developed world to have a pool of funding for communities to deal with to address the loss and damage that was going to happen, that they saw it was happening, and that it was an existential threat to their country, to their life. And this has just got exponential in the field. That's something you can see now across the board. But so it's historically, this was there, and it was not accepted in the structure of the convention. But they're very stubborn. They're very stubborn and smart people. They put in a note when they ratified the convention saying that they did not give up the right to ask for compensation and ask for reparations. So that's there. And that same note is also in the Paris Agreement, because they tried again to put compensation in the Paris Agreement, but John Kerry, for example, opposed to it. So again, they had no way to have it there. So again, they ratified the Paris Agreement, but they put this note that they did not give up their rights to ask for reparations. And the U.S. unfortunately won this battle there with the Paris Agreement, having this sort of article in a decision called Paragraph 51, where it sort of forbids countries to negotiate within the UNFCC anything regarding to liability and compensation regarding loss and damage. So the US went sort of one step more to sort of push down the political, the historical fight that countries from the Pacific started. But between the UNFCC and the Paris Agreement, many times this topic has been brought by African countries, by less developed countries, by Latin American countries. And we have some progress. For example, we have this something called the Warsaw Mechanisms on Loss and Damage, which sort of starts a dialogue on experiences and learning. But at the end, there's no funding. So if you have no funding to sort of give the for example, give money for the people that lost their houses in the last hurricanes in Central America. So what would you get with some website of experience sharing? I mean, what some expert is going to teach somebody that lost their crops or lost their house on flood about loss and damages? They just lived it. they don't need no more experience on how to deal with it. They need the resources to face it. And that's what countries need. So that has been systematically being denied since the 1990s when the UNFCCC was created. So it's not new. It's it's continually new because it never advances, because it just keeps being obstacle systematically by the global north. So it's a historical fight. It's a fight that many climate activists sort of ignore because it just keeps going for decades. And you sort of, when you begin to your journey into this sort of political space, you sort of find it and you find there is nothing about it. There is no advance. There's no money. There's not even a definition on loss and damage within the UNFCCC, because that's the point of lack of progress that this issue has. But it's completely not new. But there is a long story of political fight from the global south to ask for justice and ask for compensation on the adverse impacts of climate change.
On one hand, you have, you know, certain countries, you know, that are, you know, could disappear. Some of these small developing states, you know, could disappear in the coming decades. On the other hand, ahead of COP 21 in Paris, John Kerry famously said in a Rolling Stone interview, if you want to get something done, don't go down that road in terms of addressing loss and damage.
Well, I want to move now to Costa Rica, the Escazú Agreement. My pronunciation okay there? Samer, Adrian, tell us what this agreement is and what the story of it is and what the status of it is. Who signed on to it?
So the Escazú Agreement, it's the Latin American version of the Aarhus Convention. It's sort of, and it has a super connection with the UNFCCC. It was both, they come from the same moment in time in the 90s with the Rio Declaration, the same time with when the UNFCCC convention was created on climate change. And it's this idea that people have the right to participate at all levels in environmental decisions, because that's a human right. So the Europeans sort of made this open agreement to guarantee access rights, which is access to information, education, and capacity building and participation. So, and they had that for a long time. Latin America was in a process for many years negotiating to create its own access rights agreement, especially in this region where being a climate activist or environmental activist, it could cost your life in many countries. Even in Costa Rica, protecting turtles is something that can cost your life. It's something that has happened in the past. And it's still a threat for many, especially if you're in the rural areas. And so they basically created this agreement, which is called the Escazú Agreement for short. And it sort of guarantees also the rights of environmental defenders and the right for you to access information on the environment, the right for you to participate and have your opinions being considered when decisions are being taken on environmental issues and to access environmental justice. So this is super important in terms that it sets a standard across the board in the whole region about minimum rights that you should have in terms of participating and accessing information and accessing justice and not being killed because you care about your environment. So that is super important. Chile and Costa Rica led it. There's many meetings that took place. It got ratified already, but enough countries so it entered into force already. But the right wing in Chile sort of gained power, so they sort of forgot that they were leading it and they didn't want to ratify. Mm-hmm. Then we have the hyper-conservatives in Costa Rica that just don't want to ratify, even though like the Escazú Agreement is named for on a city here in Costa Rica. Right. So it just makes complete no sense. And then you have like this whole huge regional far-right movement with the same arguments all across the board that this Escazú Agreement is going to harm business, that that there's no need for more legislation. I mean, so it's basically a complete just failure of diplomacy. You have the two main democratic and most developed countries in the region pushing a human rights agreement that sort of already repeats the rights that most people are supposed to have in their countries, but they don't ratify it. And then you have all a whole bunch of other countries, including Argentina and Mexico, ratifying it. But us in Costa Rica and Chile, we don't. So it's just a complete contradiction of the compromise or commitment, I'm sorry, of Costa Rica in terms of human rights and sort of fulfilling what they say in public in terms of what they actually ratify in their National Assembly.
It's pretty dark when...
And I think what...
I was going to say, it's pretty dark when business will argue that it'll hurt us if we can't stomp all over the human rights of environmentalists. But go on, Sam.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, one thing that really wanted to highlight is the Escazú does provide some protections for environmental defenders. When you think about Latin America, this is the most dangerous region in the world. When you look at, under the right-wing governments of Duque in Colombia and Bolsonaro in Brazil, the amount of environmental activists that are killed each year is absolutely staggering. So just to have something that provides these basic rights, and for a country like Costa Rica to not have ratified, they've signed, ratified. It looked like it was on course for a minute to be ratified, but the business sector kicked in, and I guess you can always see the interests of big business trumps the rights of environmental defenders in this case. And it's, while it's been disappointing, there are some positives. It did go into effect this year. There's been enough countries who have signed and ratified it, especially, the big push was when Argentina under the Fernandez government, they were able to ratify it. So there is some positive. There's usually some stuff moving in the positive direction on Costa Rica's side. The leading presidential candidate saying it's not worth the time or the effort to push forward, which is really disappointing here in Costa Rica. But, we do have enough countries to have signed. And, in a lot of ways, it's innovative. And just for this region to provide those protections is so important.
I mean, you cannot argue on one side to be this sort of pillar of democracy and human rights and environmental sort of efforts, and then on the other side, just bluntly reject ratifying an agreement on human rights, supposedly that already states everything you already have in your national law. So there's a very dark and sick part of society in Costa Rica, especially everything regarding with transnationals and pineapple and big plantation and bananas that are very afraid of people having rights of talking about pesticides and controlling their territory and being able to sort of have some decision making on what happens in their communities. And that's basically it. And the arguments against this from the business sector are the same here in Costa Rica as they are in Colombia and as they are in Chile. So what it shows is just basically a very business class that is oriented against the rights of people, against the rights of environmentalists, and that it has unity across the region. It has same logic of exploiting and disregard about people. And what I find most dangerous and most hurtful is the idea that they're afraid of communities being entitled to define how to live and what conditions to set in their territory, and people being unable of participating and having a right. I mean, having a right of your land. And that is something that these market approaches of putting first what is easiest, what facilitates businesses instead of what people want and what can provide an adequate and healthy conditions for life to happen. And it's very insightful in terms that it shows that it's present there and it's very explicit, but at the same time, it's very hurtful to know that you have no control about your land.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, I was noticing Escazú was just basically a suburb of San Jose. And nope, the business class, we don't need to be part of that. Amazing stuff. But anything else you want to say, David, before we let these guys go?
Perfect.
Well, Adrián Martínez and Sam Goodman, La Ruta del Clima, thank you guys so much. This was a great conversation. Where can people follow you and your work?
But you could visit our website in larutadelclima.org or also in also social media. We're in podcasts, we're in Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. So yeah, please do follow, and hopefully you can keep track on our comments on the next climate conference.
We'll put all the links in the description and all of that, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from you all.
All right, folks. Thanks to Sam and Adrian for that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Costa Rica, yeah. I mean, it would be nice to get down there and visit those guys and talk.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wasn't joking when Sam was saying after Michael went down there, he was talking about Costa Rica nonstop. He was very, very much wanting to spend a lot of time down there.
Yeah. Maybe in the post game we'll play. Sam also has a soundboard that they've been putting together of old TMBS stuff. So maybe we'll poke around that in the post game.
That sounds like fun.
So there's an interesting article here, Jacobin. Washington Carpenters, it's up to the membership to win the strike. Interesting dynamics in this strike here. Basically, you have workers who are building mansions, among other things, for billionaires and millionaires in the Seattle area, told that they aren't allowed to, for instance, strike certain projects, for instance, Microsoft. It's really a membership versus leadership thing, which is, kind of... Maybe I'm going too far out on this, but it reminds me of what's going on with the progressives in the Democratic Party and the leadership saying no. But anyway, David, take it away.
No, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, for folks who haven't seen or aren't in the area, this is a very large and historic strike. The union, I think, represents somewhere around 11,000 workers who have... who have voted down now multiple agreements between the presented to them from the union leadership. So this has sort of been going on for a while, and fundamental to the demands of workers are things like, obviously, stuff you would expect, like higher pay, but it's things like parking. As more and more people are sort of thrown out of the cities and the communities that they're working in because they can't afford to live there, people have to drive in, and in those places you have to pay for parking, which can really start to eat in to your yearly income. I mean, these are kind of basic bread and butter demands, along with, things like better protections, better working hours, et cetera. Right. So this is one of those moments where, people are finally feeling the confidence to stand up, after seeing the union negotiate contracts that the workers, basically the rank and file workers, have found to be lacking. There's some interesting dynamics here. And I mean, maybe first and foremost, though, let's just say, complete solidarity with everybody. The pictures and the videos we've been seeing from the picket lines have been quite inspiring. Not only, union members directly picketing, but also have been met with members of the community, members of other unions, and certainly socialists, including people like Shama Sawant and the Socialist Alternative out there. And we'll get into that maybe in a moment. Because there's some controversy around that. But yeah, I mean, basically, there's rank and file tensions between, the union members and union leadership. First and foremost, it started because these workers in the union have had contracts negotiated for them that have no strike agreements. Meaning that certain people will continue to go to work even if their union, goes on strike. And we're seeing that right now, where not everybody who is in the union has, been on the picket line. Some people have been going to work because they have these no strike clauses in their contracts, which I think sort of shows, some of the difficult decline in labor power in this country, that something like that has developed in the first place. I mean, the first and foremost power that a working class has is the ability to withhold their labor, and basically negotiating away that power in a union contract, sort of defeats a lot of the purposes. I understand, the conditions that oftentimes have been really dire and difficult,
But right now, what we're seeing is workers pushing back against that concept, particularly the no strike contracts in general, but also orders and from union leadership as to what sites they could have picket lines on. And if you pull up that piece, which has, and we'll get into the organization here in a moment. I want you to go down to the bit where they have to explain how they had a fight at a meeting so that they could go and pick it outside of Microsoft.
I think this is it here, yeah. After the rally, there was this crazy screaming match between mainly the Microsoft guys and the leadership. The rally started off. This is, I should say, after the Microsoft was left off of...
So the strike has been authorized at this point, and now they're basically... people are getting information about where they can do picket lines, etc. Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, and so now this is to add Microsoft to the thing. The rally started off kind of like a pep rally, but when it came down to it, a brother from the Microsoft job began pushing for the leadership to allow us to picket the Microsoft job. Other brothers joined us in and got behind him to push for the Microsoft job, which became kind of a shouting match, and it looked like it was going to get ugly. I think something was thrown. The argument ended with the Carpenters Council head, Evelyn Shapiro, conceding that the Microsoft job would be added as a fifth job to the picket list, but it was only after the members really demanded it, and it looked like there was almost a physical fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so basically what we're seeing is a lot more militancy from rank and file and some hesitancy from union leadership.
And I just want to add to like the, not even hesitancy, but like kind of gamesmanship where Art describes that, you know, the leadership will allow you to pick at certain smaller jobs basically to like let off steam because they, like he says, like what's going to be the effect of this? And he says, ultimately it's going to diminish the effect of the morale. Everyone knows you need to protest the big jobs. Mm-hmm. Otherwise it like, right. Otherwise it's literally just a waste of energy.
Yeah. I mean, because the whole point of this is like, because if you're not creating economic pain, right, to the bosses and to the people,
it's not about being heard.
Who are negotiating the contract is if you're not giving economic pain to the people, you know, to like the bosses, you're going to just be suffering the economic pain yourself, right? Because if you're not going into work and you're sort of losing that money, right? It just means that the workers themselves are the ones who are getting hit. Now, just to, you know, to be clear about this, the union says is that the reason that they can't do this is because they are afraid of lawsuits, something that many of the rank and file members have sort of rejected. I will just note anecdotally and historically, the state of law in the United States when it comes to labor rights is ridiculous and it is horrendous. But I will also say, and you know, I'm not saying these things lightly because, you know, going on strike, taking these conflicts, that is dangerous for yourself and for your family. You can lose your income. You can be, you know, ostracized. You know, like these are not things that we're taking lightly here. Right. But it should be known that unions were illegal. All of these things were illegal at one point or another, right? And it was the fact that people were getting together and were refusing to concede these fundamental rights that we were able to enshrine them in law in the first place. And we might have to get to a place where that happens again. But anyway. I wanted to, if you could go down in that article again, Matt, to the section, what do you see as the union leadership's motivation for this strategy? And just to be clear, I don't know if you said before, this is an interview in Jacobin with one of the rank and file members who is a member of the Peter J. McGuire group. And we'll put up some of their demands in a moment. But this is the big claim here and why there's so much tension. What do you see as the union leadership's motivation for the strategy? The union leadership has taken on this market share philosophy over the years and has basically come to see itself as a labor broker, not as a union. A labor broker is a company that takes labor and sells it. Our union has become a sophisticated version of that, taking in carpenters and selling them off to the contractors. Because its perspective on what a union is has changed. Because it's selling us to the contractors, it doesn't want to sell us for too high of a rate. It has begun to see itself as a partner of the contractors instead of having opposing interests. Mm. The union has fought for years to keep our wages rising at a very meager rate instead of really fighting. It has also tried this whole summer to dampen the militancy of the membership. So if I'm going to pull this up now. So that is coming from a member there. And again, you know, there are factions and there are fights and conflicts within all of the membership. But I think it's really important to get these views out there, because I'll tell you what, corporate media specifically, and I mean this like in the most literal sense ever, business press in the Seattle, Washington area has just been lying off their ass about the demands of the workers and all this kind of stuff, and doing a hell of a lot of red baiting and things of that nature, saying basically, you know, these things have been infiltrated by reds, etc. And I think that really needs to be pushed back against. And I'm going to share this right here with y'all. Which is the set of demands from the Peter J. McGuire Group, which is a faction within the union there in Washington. Let me just read these demands for y'all. Brothers and sisters, rank and file carpenters of this union are currently sacrificing our livelihoods in order to participate in this strike. We need a quick and decisive victory so that we may return to work as soon as possible with a strong contract in hand. But here are what they're calling for. The picketing of strikeable projects with the highest possible economic impact to the AGC in ascending order. The picketing of as many projects as possible, given the available numbers of pickets, with no more than one captain and five pickets per gate, unless exceptional circumstances require more. A list of strikeable projects which may be picketed to be released to the membership immediately. The immediate training of rank and file and job steward picket captains. The relocation of most pickets from projects which have been successfully shut down to other nearby active projects. And here's where we get some big ones. Picketing to continue unceasingly without break days for the contractors. That's critical to create that economic punishment for them. 7, no further deals with AGC signatory contractors that deny carpenters their right to strike. So that's a demand right there to end these no strike clauses and contracts. And 8, all current sweetheart agreements with no strike clauses to be ratified by the membership via secret ballot as per section 39A of the council's bylaws. We urge you to join with us in making the strike successful. So those are very clear demands. Obviously they go along with the demands for a better contract. But we are seeing, the strikes there are, the strikes in Washington, this has been going on for weeks now, is another really, I mean, it's a horrible moment in the sense of, you know, what people are having to go through and what they had to go through to get here. But it's very encouraging to see an increase in this kind of labor militancy, not just in Washington, but all around the country. And if we're going to win in the long run, we need to be thinking about these fundamental structures and the ways that we've been organizing in the past, in order to make sure that working people all across this country and hell all around the world get the rights, dignity, and pay that they deserve.
Yeah. The technocratic structures are not going to work basically anywhere. And the only time this country really ever worked was when it was forced to by radicalism and just demand, right? And not, you know, let's all work in a partnership with the people that are fleecing us.
I think you're right. And we also can't, ignore also the Shama Sawant and the socialist alternative aspect to this story too. So I don't know how familiar you are with this, but from the get-go, as you would expect, Shama Sawant and socialist alternative in Seattle in particular, you know, that's a group that shows up. People can disagree with tactics and lines and things like that, but that's just a group that certainly shows up. Mm-hmm. Shama Sawant, in fact, has, you know, pledged to donate $10,000 from their solidarity fund to a strike fund if it is to be set up, which is a whole other can of worms. But as all of this has been happening, Shama Sawant has been attacked by members of the business press and also by some members of union leadership, saying that she is just agitating, using this as a photo op, using this to further her own political career, and trying to encourage people to basically, you know, be more militant, to risk themselves getting sued, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I think that these things just have to be called out as categorically false and incorrect. While, you know, not everybody, I think, in those unions is necessarily a member of the socialist alternatives or even
a fan of Shama Sawant. You know, she has been welcome there and encouraged to be there, just like anybody else.
Done.
And, you know, including having, you know, letters of support from rank and file membership in support of her being there. I just think that those kind of accusations are just complete bogus. And you also need to remember, if you're just sort of zooming in and out of this story, right, that there is this fundamental conflict here, right? One between, you know, workers and bosses, right? Between the workers and the contractors. But also, there's tensions within the union itself, right? So everybody's trying to find ways to score points against one another. So we'll certainly be, you know, keeping tabs on that, unless you had anything else you wanted to.
I think just one note to say is Art, the carpenter interviewed, does say that the leadership is responding to some of their, you know, the demand they're basically laying down. So just to note that it's not, they're not hitting a brick wall here, even though it's nearly.
Yeah, but they're definitely, but at the same time, as the quote and the headline of the article goes, it's up to the membership to win the strike.
Absolutely,
yeah. And I think that kind of shift is thinking about things bottom up.
Well, and I just think it's ridiculous.
That's just fundamental to a lot of left wing socialist politics and the kind of developments that we need to be seeing in general.
That's why, to me, the Sawant thing seems ridiculous. Like, I mean, I wish we had more politicians that, you know, take time out of their day to show solidarity with 2,000 striking carpenters, like as a photo op. I mean, it's an easy thing to say, really.
Yeah, and you can read it in the Seattle Business Journal.
Right, exactly. Something
that leftists and other folks should not be parroting.
God. All right. Well, on that note, I also just wanted to comment just on the interview, one of the dynamics Adrian pointed out, which is how we're financing this. Like, this should just be like giving cash, right? Like, we F up the environment and collect interest on the reaction to it.
Oh, yeah.
Hell yeah, baby. I mean, the fucking West, really, they really got this whole like evil overload shit down.
I know. I mean, it is amazing when you know, sometimes when you're sort of like glancing through an article, and you miss like keywords, right? Like, talking about the electric train that they're building in Costa Rica, they're like, oh, look, it's nice. The United States is helping them do it. And then it's like, oh, loan, right? Here's a big loan that, you know, we're going to expect you to pay back. And, you know, the United States has a really, really sweet relationship, with Central America in particular, as a lender. They never really ask for much in return for that, right?
And how that spot of land came to have the name Costa Rica, and what was in the minds of the people naming it at that time, anyway.
That's like, very true too.
Really, it was all written. Anyways, folks, patrons, we will see you in about 20 minutes or so. We'll have this, you know, more and more people are saying the Weinsteins kind of charlatans. I don't know what they're talking about. Sam Harris and some other, I believe Stanford-based researchers. Just interesting, because they're still Jordan Peterson fans. So, you know,
it's... Seeing that whole structure just sort of break up and fragment has been very fun to see. I'm looking forward to the breakdown.
It's really nice. And we've got some other stuff for you, too. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. Come join us. come replace a couple of Bitcoin people that really don't like our recent output, maybe. And yeah, folks, we will see you. David, can you actually hit us with some music?
Oh, yeah, I can do that.
If that's possible.
Then. Super producer David Grissom is on the case. You ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right. See y'all later.